Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, Jean-Marc Grodi, here on EWTN. And once again, we have this great opportunity to come together for a story of faith and conversion. We're joined tonight by Dr. Matthew Levering. He's a former Quaker, and he entered the church in 1995, and he's now the Perry Chair of Theology at Mundelein Seminary. We're really honored to have him here tonight to share his story. Mm-hmm. Matthew, thank you for being here. It's been a long time coming. We've had you on our radar and in the network for a long time, but it's great to finally have you here to share your story.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the beginning. Where did you grow up, and what was the faith background of your family?
Well, Quaker. Okay. My family moved around, Maryland, Tennessee, Indiana. My father was a college professor. Okay. But really, the real background is I want to give you a sense of where my parents were coming from. My mom was a convert from Southern Baptist. She'd grown up Southern Baptist in Mount Airy, North Carolina. And that was Mayberry. It was Andy Griffith.
Right.
But she saw wonderful people, but she saw a lot of racism growing up. And, of course, this was, she was born in 1946. So she was right there in the civil rights movement, and she saw a lot of racism, and it really did. She really sort of reacted against that. Mm-hmm. But my father, he grew up in a Quaker family, and so they lived. They had a apple and cherry orchard right there across the border in Virginia. It's all down 77 if you go down there. Yeah. So Virginia, North Carolina border. And they met in high school, but my father's family was his father in particular was devoted to essentially to half-time work on the orchard, and then half-time work in terms of world peace and bringing about social justice in a profound way, and he lived with incredible simplicity. So he had this sense that life was tremendously serious. That we had this opportunity to really change the world, and that each person really counted.
Yeah.
And so he lived with a profound Quaker simplicity. He gave away when he made money, he gave it away. Of course, that in some ways was irritating because he didn't have any money, And yeah, so that was their background. And I grew up Quaker. My mom became a Quaker. Mm-hmm. And my father, had, of course, grown up in that context.
Sure. What did so growing up as a Quaker? What did worship look like? What did the prayer life look like? Give us a sort of a picture of that for those who aren't familiar with that background.
Well, okay. So I grew up in different Quaker meetings, but the first Quaker meeting was in Pipe Creek, and it was in a rural Maryland. And so we would drive there, and there was only about 10 people there. Mm-hmm. It was an old Quaker meeting house, though. It was quite a historic place, but not many Quakers left. But what you would do is you would sit around in a circle, and in silence. The problem with it was that people would speak out of the silence, but what they would usually have to say in the Quaker meetings that I went to would be political. They might tell some of their story, but the bottom line was in the Quaker meetings I grew up, people did not believe in God. Mm-hmm. And so they would be talking more about social justice or politics.
Was that a shift from what your father grew up with? This shift more toward the political and this.
Well, with my father, I don't think it was. They'd grown up Quaker, but much more. My grandfather was social justice and changing the world, mm-hmm. world peace, mm-hmm. That was his vision. They did a lot on the Law of the Sea and did all sorts of world peace initiatives. Mm-hmm. My grandfather did. And then my father's family, of course, was very, my father and his brothers and sisters were very academic, and many of them became professors. He was from a family of six, his siblings. But they became professors that would be strongly, what you might call Democratic Party political initiatives or whatnot. But yeah, so if you go in Quaker meeting, we'd sit around in the silence, and then people would speak out in the silence. What I remember about it most really was from those early years was just this sense that these people were willing to be different. In other words, they were not just simply going to float along the culture.
Sure.
You know, that they were actually willing to be different in a serious way. And I also found, so I respected that.
Yeah.
And then I also, another thing, we moved to Indiana to a bigger Quaker meeting right by Earlham College, which is a Quaker college. So what I found there is I met a good number of Quakers who were really willing to risk everything. So they lived, they essentially, you might call them hippies, but they weren't, they were people who would not pay taxes, you know, because it would support the military industrial or anything military.
Right.
They were, in other words, they lived kind of the Quaker peace testimony in a really serious way that involved a lot of personal suffering. And so I admired that. I admired seeing people who really were, now most Quakers were not this, but I did admire seeing real radicals who were willing to put it on the line. Just they really put their lives on the line.
Yeah.
And I found that very inspiring.
So up to this point, how did it all impact you? Did you come to know God, to know Christ at this point in your life, or were you, how did it strike you?
Oh, no, so as a kid, no, I don't remember, the people that I was around all this time that I'm describing, I don't remember knowing anybody. My mom, to some degree, believed in God, and that became increasing. I remember we were at a Quaker Friends General meeting, something like a Friends General meeting, or I forget what the name is, but it's a big gathering of Quakers, and this was, and there was, I remember my mom, I was about 12 or 13, and my mom came back saying there had been a big fight about Christology, about low Christology or high Christology, and she was all worked up about it, but the main point was that nobody believed in Jesus. It was really more a matter of, there wasn't really any belief in Jesus as the divine Son of God and the incarnate Lord. The high Christology wasn't even that high.
Yeah.
But so no, there wasn't belief in God or Jesus, and I had no knowledge of God or Jesus.
Gotcha.
But what I did have was a deep yearning I yearned for God.
Yeah.
And so How that manifested itself was I had a number of physical problems because I was born with a it's called multiple ectoses, or I don't know what the medical name is, but I had to have some surgeries. It's essentially an orthopedic condition, so I had to have some surgeries, and I remember and I would have to go to doctors at Johns Hopkins. This is when we were in Maryland, and I remember this sense of deep vulnerability, you know, deep, and so sort of wondering, you know, was there a God? What's the meaning of all this? You know, what are we doing here? that was a big issue for me, right from 5 or 6 years old.
Yeah,
you know.
And how old were you when you guys were in Maryland?
Well, I left when I was 10.
10, okay. All right. So what happened next?
Well, so it was an interesting time. You know, one of the big things for me was when we moved to Indiana, that was a big shift. We moved from Indiana to North Carolina when I was in 10th grade. And that was a big shift for me. It was because, I really got to know my grandfather and my grandpa and grandma, you know, is what I call them. And they remember they were the ones who ran the orchard, who I mentioned already, and they ran the orchard there, right on the border, Ayrat, Virginia, right by Mount Airy. But they just deeply impressed me. I got to spend time in their orchard and got to spend a lot of time with them, you know, working there in the summer. And but the thing that it struck me was that my grandpa and my grandma too. But they'd of course done a lot in their lives in terms of peacemaking and so on, but my grandpa was just—he was so serious about the passion that he had. He still had so much zeal, you know, for you know, for living and for making an impact. He had a vision. It wasn't just about you're gonna grow up and you're going to make a living. You know, it was that you're gonna grow up and you're gonna make a big impact. That was his vision, his sense of self. And I was struck by that. I really was, and very inspired. And then, but on top of that, though, there was the element that I saw my grandparents as they began to deal with very serious physical ailments. I mean, they were still strong, but my grandma, right at that time, began to get a it's wherever your heart begins to not be able to pump enough. I can't remember what it's called, but the bottom line was that she fainted at one point.
Yeah,
a very strong and wonderful woman. She was in her mid-70s. She fainted, and I didn't think anything of it. But she then began to tell me that, we had this talk, and the talk for me was extremely important. Now at this time, I'd had some surgeries and so on. But she began to tell me about that she felt so deeply vulnerable to annihilation. In other words, she expected to be annihilated. And she told me that she would spend nights where my grandpa would be asleep, but she'd be there watching TV or just sort of in a panicked state. She couldn't sleep. She would have this panicking because she felt like she was on the edge of eternal annihilation. And she just enjoyed it. She was full of life. In the sense, she was an amazing people person,
yeah.
and a real leader. And she just loved family, and she loved loving and knowing people and loving people. She was incredible, and she just felt like all that was going to be taken away. She was going to be annihilated forever. And I found that, I found the same thing also with my grandpa. You know, that he too expressed to me that sense of eternal annihilation, that there was nothing after death, nothing. And in fact, he said that he actually told me, although he was an incredibly intelligent man, he actually did tell me though that he thought there could not be a God. And I asked him why. He said, well, you know, when they sent up the space things, they didn't see anything. There was nothing, all there was the universe. He didn't have any concept of what God could be. But he had a concept of eternal annihilation that he would express to me in moments of vulnerability.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a powerful thing for me.
Yeah. Well, because there's sort of a deep existential prayer just in the honesty of that,
yeah.
of that vulnerability, of that recognition, again, however it's expressed or however it's received, that is what it would mean were there no God.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? That life really is that fragile and temporary.
Yeah.
Yeah, that must have been a very profound thing, yeah.
Yeah, for me it was. And so these are people who are committed to living a Quaker life of real service to others, and especially my grandpa who just gave everything. He never held on to any money. He lived incredibly simply. He lived beyond simply.
Yeah,
he never... I mean, he always wore the same overalls and the same suit, and he really was an inspiration. But here he was telling me that that life was so meaningful. On the one hand, you see, on the one hand, he was telling me that life was so meaningful,
right?
It was so important. But then on the other hand, he was telling me that that we're facing eternal annihilation. We're going to turn to dirt, and to my mind, that seemed like, well, that doesn't seem like that much. In other words, there was a contradiction there, but he had such high ideals, and he had this sense that there was something important,
yeah.
and something to sacrifice for, And so I took that part,
yeah.
For sure. Now another thing, you don't mind if I go on these stories?
Please, this is fascinating.
Okay, yeah. So another thing that happened to me was that when I was 20 years old, right? I'll get back to some of my college experiences, but one thing that was really important for me was that I was hiking in the mountains of Annecy, France, right near, and I'd been in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And so Annecy is right across the border from Switzerland. And so we were hiking in there, and my brother and me and my girlfriend at the time. And this was when I was 20. And we were there, and before we'd gone, I'd felt sort of like a really sharp pain in my left leg. But all my childhood I'd had all sorts of different pains, you know, from this condition I had.
Right.
And so I felt this really sharp pain. I thought when I was swimming, and I thought, well, gosh, but then I just sort of, and a kind of a little nagging pain, but I just sort of we had the tickets, so off we went. Well, it turned out that after we'd been hiking, my girlfriend saw that I had some blood pooling, a small amount of blood pooling in my left foot. And so I didn't think anything of it myself, but she said and I was having pain, you know, so she said I better go to the doctor. So when we got to Annecy, France, I did, and I had a little hole in my artery, you know, a tiny little hole, mm-hmm. Caused by, I'd had a surgery that left a little sharp thing and so on.
Sure.
Anyway, so I had this hole. And so I thought, my gosh. And I was right up there. Essentially, I'd been hiking in the middle of the Alps, you know, I thought to myself, I remember just thinking this was a crazy thing that, that I had been close to death.
Right.
But right before the surgery, about a day before, I had this amazing experience of God's presence. Yeah, it was really really something. I can't even describe without feeling emotional.
Yeah.
And of course, I didn't even really believe in. I didn't know anything about God. I mean, I knew what I'd read in some novels, and that's the college experience that I could get back to.
Yeah.
Is that I was always a big novel reader, and so there were things that happened, things that I learned in college that were important to me. Mm-hmm. But I had this presence. It really was amazing. The sense that everything would be well, everything was totally under control, and it was just a powerful thing that pulsed through me for some minutes. It was amazing.
Yeah,
it felt like some minutes.
Yeah.
So I couldn't really understand it.
Yeah.
But it was quite moving for me. But then another thing that happens after the surgery, then I tried to read the New Testament and I read a gospel. But I found to myself that I didn't understand a word of it. Jesus seemed so alien to me. I just didn't know. He was saying these things, and some of the things he said sounded interesting, but it all felt like it just felt to me completely alien. I couldn't relate to it.
Yeah.
Some of the things he said, I thought were profound, but this intensity, this sort of eschatological urgency, the sense of the kingdom, and then kind of the sharpness of everything, you know, I couldn't relate to it. I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
I mean, I wanted to, you know, I wanted to. I got one of those little New Testaments, those little
right.
pocket New Testaments. Yeah, but I couldn't make head or tail of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So where did you go from there? Did you continue pursuing it, or did you set it aside for a bit?
Well, I continued to pursue. I continued to seek because I was then a rising junior,
okay.
and I was transferring to North Carolina to get married to my girlfriend, who I've been married to now for 32 years.
Oh, wonderful.
Mm. At least if my count is right. She's such a wonderful person, and we've had a wonderful marriage. But I was transferring in the middle. I transferred from Wesleyan University in Connecticut, where one of my uncles taught, and that was where I'd gone for my first 2 years. But mm-hmm. there in Wesleyan, I was a searcher. You know, I'd been reading Walker Percy and all that, and
yeah.
I've been my uncle was very interested in Walker Percy.
Yeah,
and so I'd read that, but I took classes on Russian literature. Mm-hmm. And so these figures seem to know something about God or Jesus that I needed to know.
At the same time, I feel like those figures are significant because on the one hand, they have that sense of God and of Christ, right? But they're also all, a lot of the writers from that period, and you know, Dostoevsky and Percy are two that I know that come up in your story, but they also had a real sense of the profundity of the fragility of existence, right? Like those two really had, like, I think of, again, your grandfather, his zeal and his poignant sense of the meaningfulness of life, but also, you know, the fear of the unknown and of what comes after death if there's nothing. I feel like those authors really had a sense for the sharpness of those things.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They really did. So, yeah, Tolstoy, who struggled so much, and Tolstoy was one of the key novelists that I read as you know, probably like 18 or 19 years old. Mm. Tolstoy struggled so much, and one thing that was interesting about Tolstoy is as he searched for God, you know, and of course the characters of War and Peace are always searching for God.
Yeah.
But they don't. I mean, they can't. They don't really know that much. They have no way to search and find. They find themselves frustrated a lot of times. And so different characters there in War and Peace are sort of, you know, facing their mortality, like Andre sort of gazing up to the sky and seeing the beauty of everything while the war is raging around him, the battle. You know, but he doesn't really find anything. In other words, Tolstoy's characters are frustrated. They have this zeal and this love. They have this intense love and this sense of beauty, but they're frustrated. They don't find anything. And of course, in Tolstoy's own life, it becomes his novels get more and more bitter. You know, until by the end, you know, he's writing, you know, quite dark,
right?
Because he doesn't really find anything. He's searching. You know, he has a lot of zeal. But he, I always think that Tolstoy, I was very struck by Tolstoy's dying, because in a certain way it was like my own grandpa's, how he died. And he died right around, you know, a couple of years after, you know, I had this thing with my artery.
Yeah.
But yeah, Tolstoy, of course, gets on a train and he's going to outrace death. You know, in other words, he sees death coming, and so he rushes off to a train and decides to take off and to escape, you know, because he does have this sense of annihilation, you know. Yeah, so again, it's, these novels were important for me, this background.
Yeah. So you moved back to, was it North Carolina? Something?
Yeah, that's right, to transfer to North Carolina.
And what was the school that you transferred to?
UNC Chapel Hill.
All right, okay.
Yeah, so... and my father had gone there. He'd gone there on a Moorhead scholarship, and so it was. It felt, you know, good.
What were you studying at the time?
Well, at the time, my father, he was an American historian,
okay,
and ended up teaching at Davidson. But so I was studying history, and this was another set of very, very important things happened to me there, because I was studying history, but then I would take a bunch of literature courses.
Yeah.
So I took. A fantastic course on Dostoevsky, for example. But what really happened to me was that as I took this, I began to study the history of the religious history of the American South. I began to focus in on the American South, and I suspect in the back of my mind I was thinking that this is what I would do, you know, because I was always someone who enjoyed books and enjoyed reading. And writing papers, I learned how to do that. I mean, it was quite difficult, but I learned how.
Yeah.
And so, by that time, I'm now a junior in college, and so as I was still searching. And so I thought, well, this is the way that this will help me search. I'll learn about the history of the American religious South. You know, both African American and you know, the white Southerners. Mm-hmm. But what I got into was this course taught by I've forgotten his, Donald Matthews, and he became sort of my mentor. But what Donald Matthews was is he was a former Methodist. He was a former Methodist pastor who lost his faith in the 1960s, but who had then become a historian of the old Methodists. But what was interesting about him was that his classes, he preached the gospel. He preached the gospel, trying to get the students to understand what the real history of the South. He was preaching the gospel like the Methodist circuit riders. You know, it was like he was on a horse, like back there riding, being a circuit rider. He was trying to give us a sense of really what were they preaching?
Yeah.
You know, what were they proclaiming? And of course, then he would tell us that he didn't believe it. He didn't believe it at all. But he was another important figure for me. He was. And so he too believed that he was facing annihilation.
Yeah.
He would talk about that in class actually, because he during that year that I was with him, he discovered a there was sort of an aneurysm that he had, the doctors discovered that hadn't spread, but he was just very open, you know, about these type of things. And so he was another important figure.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break there, and then we'll come back in a couple of minutes and hear the rest of it.
Okay.
So thanks for being here, and stay tuned. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Dr. Levering's story. I want to remind you that if you are a convert to the Catholic Church, we'd love to hear your story. We'd love to be praying with you and for you on your continuing journey. We'd also love to have you as part of the Coming Home Network as we help others. We share our stories and we help encourage others who are in the midst of this search, you know, for the truth, for understanding this great gift of the Church that Christ wants to give them. And so check out chnetwork.org and click join to become a part of the network and receive our newsletter. We'd love to connect with you there. But we'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Dr. Levering's story. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Dr. Matthew Levering. He's a former Quaker. He entered the Catholic Church in 1995 and is now the Perry Chair of Theology at Mundelein Seminary. Matthew, it's been so great hearing your story so far. And I was thinking during the break that, there are many people, this theme that's kind of emerging in your story of people, yourself included, your grandparents, some of your professors, some of the authors you're reading, wrestling with this hiddenness of God, wrestling with sort of the darkness of faith, even the dark night of faith, we might even say, using some of those classic spiritual terms. I feel like it's such an important part of these stories to come out with, because there are people who wrestle with that, and to know that there are others wrestling with it. Even, again, you were talking about your professed atheist professor who became a sort of mentor of yours. And, you know, there is something refreshing about the honesty of the of that person who is clear about what they believe and is wrestling with that. I was struck by that. It was very, very interesting. But let's pick it up there. You're studying now under this professor there at the university in North Carolina.
Yeah, that's right, Chapel Hill.
Okay.
It was he was a truly great man. He was. He may still be alive. I don't think so. So I was sitting there, and you're right. He was a man of deep wrestling.
Yeah.
Now again, a lot of the people that I saw who were wrestling or who were seekers simply had no way forward. You know, they didn't they didn't know where they would even go to look to think about these things. You know,
yeah.
Again, you got to remember that for Quakers, there's no Bible. I'm the kind of Quaker that I grew up in. You know, don't think of evangelical Quakers.
Right.
These are silent friends, more like Unitarian in a way.
Sure.
But no Bible, no God, and no Jesus. It doesn't mean individual Quakers may have some of that, but right. I didn't really encounter that.
Sure.
But anyway, so I was studying with a guy, and so. The fun part of the story, I tortured this poor professor. I really did. But so one of the things I decided I worked with my father, and my father was doing a research project on public opinion in relation to essentially to World War I, to Wilson, to different things going on in New Jersey and North Carolina. And so he was doing this. It was a, he was working on a paper for his, a fetra for his teacher at Princeton, who was a very, very prominent professor. And so I was a research assistant for my father. And so what we were doing is, you know, studying old newspapers. We would go down to microfilm and microfiche and, you know, just go through old newspapers, both in North Carolina and in New Jersey. So anyway, so I come up with the idea that what I'm going to do is I'm going to go do a similar research project. But because my professor was very interested in the ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, and the debates around that, I was going to do the debates around the abortion issue, you know, the coming of abortion and how people in North Carolina, especially in the 1970s, you know, think in your mind, 69, 70, 71, 72. Those were the years that I focused on.
Right.
So I got started doing this research project. But of course, my professor was horrified, you know, because remember, I began to go to his office and because as I was doing this research, I realized that what they were talking about. Remember, I was born in 1971. Mm-hmm. I realized that what they were talking about was that that they really had a right to. It quickly became personal.
Yeah,
you know, I quickly saw that they were saying that that some people didn't need to live, or some people could be killed, it really was amazingly quick before I sort of personalized it. I completely personalized it. I just said, because I'd always been in favor of abortion. I never cared at all, but what struck me was these arguments were so bad. Mm. But then what really struck me was. They are saying that my mom would have a right to kill me. You know, that in other words, that somebody had a right to kill me, you know, when I was in the womb or whatever. And for some reason, that just really struck me. Yeah. And I just sort of reacted like this, you know, very strong, just sort of like, how in the world? You know, that no one ever had a right to kill me. And it was very personal. But so I would go and argue with my professor. And so he just sort of shut me down, and that was sort of the last gasp of him mentoring me, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. But and then I sort of found myself sort of an outsider, and I wasn't able to complete that. I wasn't able to do that senior thesis at the university. Now, you didn't have to do a senior thesis, but I found that I could get nobody to work with me on that thesis. My professor, my mentor, wouldn't do it, and neither would anybody else that I could find. So that really struck me. It shook me sort of to the core, because there I realized that something was deeply wrong within the circles that I lived in. Remember, all Quakers that I knew were in favor of abortion. It wasn't. Like someone might speak out of silence about their experience helping people get abortions. You know, this was something that I'd heard at meeting,
yeah.
You know, so it wasn't, it was that kind of thing. So that sort of really shook me. It really shook me. I thought there's something really deeply false here.
Yeah.
Even though there's so much great zeal, there's so much passion for, there's willingness to be countercultural, you know, there's willingness really that a sense of your life is important. You know, I began to see there's something really false here that I have to get to the bottom of, as it were.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was a big part of all this.
Okay. Well, what did you do with that? Where'd you go next?
Well, so what happens was is that after college, during that year where I didn't do the senior thesis, you know, but my wife and I were married. We got married in college, of course. And so I didn't do the senior thesis, but so I began to think, okay, but so how do I investigate? How do I go forward? So what I come up with the idea that I would do is that I would seek to learn, through literature. You know, because literature. Remember, I didn't know theology existed. Mm-hmm. I didn't know You could have hit me with a divinity school, and I wouldn't have known what they would have. I knew nothing about
sure,
that.
Sure, okay.
Yes, I didn't know anything about theology, but I did know about literature. And so, and of course, at University of North Carolina really was where I picked up Walker Percy. My uncle at that time was just very interested, but he, not from any sort of religious perspective, but just as my uncle had attempted to be a screenwriter, but and was a playwright, and still is alive, a very, very fine person, and a gifted playwright. And so he'd gone out to L.A. and he had come back and was running the orchard by this time, you know, taking over my grandfather, but he was an influence because he liked the literary craft. He and an aunt of mine were very literary, wonderful people, and still are, still alive. But so they had an impact on me. And so what I thought was, okay, I'll do like Walker Percy, like the moviegoer.
Yeah.
And I'll do a quest, and I'll do it by trying to become. Remember, Walker Percy was a North Carolina grad. And so I'll do a quest like that. I'll become a novelist. You know, that didn't seem. I just thought, well, why not? You know, I'll become a great novelist. I mean, that was what I thought. I would write great novels.
Yeah.
So after college, that's what I did. Is I just sat down, and my wife was a little bit taken aback, but we had some extra money from my other side of the family. My other grandmother had given me some college money that I'd saved. And so we had extra money, and my wife was going to grad school at Duke Sanford Public Policy Institute right when it was founded. And so we were there at right off campus at just moved from Chapel Hill to Durham. And so we were just right by the campus there. But so I was busy becoming a great novelist. And so what happened is that as I wrote, I could easily write novels, it turned out. The only problem with it was they were terrible. I wrote at least three novels, none of which were any, it was a complete disaster because I have no ear for voices and no eye it's a purely intellectual. But so what I was doing is just really just seeking through the writing. I was literally just seeking.
Yeah.
But so at this time, though, I'd left the Quaker meeting, and we were listening to the sermons at African American Methodist Church, and then also at the Methodist Church, United Methodist, there in Chapel Hill. So I didn't think about becoming a Methodist. I was just listening to the sermons, you know, and just kind of saying, well, what's out there? You know, that was what I was interested in. And of course, anyway, so during this time, though, I was busy writing novels. And all of a sudden, though, and of course, the novels were terrible, and I threw them out immediately, but all of a sudden what happened to me was I realized that no matter what I write, or no matter what these literary people write, it's just fiction. You know, it may have some basis in kind of yearnings, but it's just fiction. And I just thought to myself, and I've never been an optimist, I thought to myself, well, what's the likelihood? I just said, what's the likelihood of all this? You know, and I just came to this all of a sudden it just struck me, and I said, God doesn't exist. And so I really just came sort of to a crashing halt of my seeking. And I just sort of came to this point where I just said, God doesn't exist. It's just more probable. I mean, if God did exist, I thought to myself, well, you know, where is God? And it just, what's the probability? The probability is we're going to be dirt. You know, that was what this was in 1993, 94.
Right.
And I just thought, this was really probably like fall, like probably September 93.
Yeah.
So I just thought to myself, you know, I really am an atheist. And so I just sort of crashed. And so my seeking just ended really. And I just said, it was a fascinating experience to be an atheist to me. So I was actually sort of interested by the thing. And so I looked around And as I was going around, I wasn't depressed. I was perfectly sane and normal. And I just, everything that I would go around in stores, I would see stores or just, I just remember a very powerful experience of just, these are total shells. It's just a shell upon kind of like a sea of annihilation, a sea of nothingness, and a sea of change. And so these, you would see these restaurants with bustling people, but it's just a shell. It's just here today, gone tomorrow, complete, it's like scenery from a play. And so I had a strong sense that everything was utterly ephemeral and it's a shell, a fake, you know, that all these lives were nothing. You know, I didn't think that people were nothing, but I just thought just that everything is built on a sand. It's like built on, it's like, as it were, being in a desert and seeing a little trees planted somewhere, but, you know, you're in a desert and it's all going to be sucked up by the sand and the next sandstorm or whatever.
Right.
Anyway, so this was my sense. I just had this strong sense that everything is a shell and it's all a fake. It's just, there's nothingness is the reality. And so this lasted for 3 days. And I really didn't have, it was only 3 days of atheism. But on the third day, I thought to myself, well, this sort of emptiness, this nothingness, I said, this may be so, but before I become an atheist permanently, I better go try to figure out whether anyone's ever written about God or said anything about God, you know, or Jesus or all these things that I've been reading about in novels. So I thought, is there any place I can go? And so I thought, well, why don't I go over to Duke Divinity School Library? Because we were right across, we were literally, a 5-minute walk.
Right.
So I thought, gosh, I'd never even known there was a library, but I knew there was a Divinity School there because we'd gone on Duke campus.
Yeah.
As I was saying, my wife was studying there. Yeah. And so I went over there. And I went in the library, and so I saw a bunch of, it was very significant for me at the time that I saw a bunch of books on their new bookshelf. This was the key thing, is as soon as I get in there, on their new bookshelf are these books with a little stripe on it. You know, they're on the, I'm talking on the spine, a little stripe, and they were Ignatius Press books.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was 94, it was still probably fall 93, but right in fall 93, Ignatius had been publishing a lot, and so Duke Divinity School hadn't bought everything, but was starting to, like, they'd realized they had to buy them, these translations and other things, and so they were really realizing they had to buy this stuff, and so they were on the new bookshelf, therefore, they were picking them up, you know. Mm-hmm. Ignatius wasn't that old at that time. It was only like 10 years old or, you know, 15.
Yeah.
And anyway, so this was big for me. And so I get in there. And remember, the gift that I always had was reading. And I've always had that academic ability.
Yeah.
So there is where, within a few days there, I begin quickly, you know, to move toward not only toward faith, but very quickly to move toward the Catholic faith.
You know, it's interesting, you know, again, there's always this mystery of grace of, you know, why does someone come to faith at a certain time? It's almost like God allowed you to get all the way to the total openness and honesty to even the atheism and then drop these books in your lap.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
We have about 10 minutes left. So what did you read and how did it impact you?
I read a lot of, I do have that ability for the quick reading. So yeah. I read a couple hundred books or whatever. But what I was looking for, I first kind of looked for books on God, about God. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that, and in addition to some of these Ignatius Press. But I looked for books about God and about Jesus. You know, I wanted to know, why would people believe in God? You know, could you write about God in any way that would be rational, or was it more just a literary hope? You know, and so I was affected. I mean, of course, I read Chesterton, I read C.S. Lewis, I read a bunch of stuff. But one of the big books that I read was by a Jesuit, whose name I've completely forgotten, and it And for it wouldn't have been an impactful book for other people, I don't think. But for me, it was a very impactful book. And it was a book about, it was just, the title was something like about poetry and prayer. And I've forgotten the exact title. But what the main point was, though, was that poetry is not prayer. That literature is not, essentially the point was, literature is not prayer, it's not theology. Now, I understand that that literature is very close, it's very integrated with prayer and with theology. Mm-hmm. I understand that now, but at the time it was very, very liberating for me because I realized that I didn't have to rely, nor did these people, but I didn't have to rely upon literature. You know, that there was a lot more of deep thought, deep theological, deep reflection upon God, mm-hmm. and reflection upon Jesus. You know, that I could probe. So I read N.T. Wright, his early stuff.
Right.
And but I read a bunch of stuff. Now for me the favorite book though, I don't think other people would find it necessary, but for me the book that was most impactful and really led me to become a Catholic in a way, although they all did. I became a Catholic very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the most impactful book was Hans-Urs von Balthasar's book called In the Fullness of Faith. Mm. And what that is it's about Catholicity, or you know, the mark of the church, Catholicity.
Yeah.
But what I saw though was that he was able to draw together all the aspects of the faith that I had not understood, you know, that before, you know, of course I had no contact before I was Catholic. But as I was reading these books, I was beginning to get a sense. And then when I read that book, In the Fullness of Faith, I saw that it was a coherent unity. You know, it was incredibly rich. I've read the book since, and I haven't necessarily had the same response. I still like the book,
yeah.
But so then anyway, then it was a matter of persuading my wife that we had to become Catholic, and that was that also just the whole I just come home to her one time. This all happened very quickly.
Yeah.
But I come home and I say to her, we were living in an apartment, of course. And I say, look, I think we've got to become Catholic. And of course she looks at me like I'm crazy because she'd grown up a Presbyterian, and they'd gone to church every week, but she was more like a nominal, she wasn't particularly Christian.
Right.
Nor was she anti-Christian. It was just more of a nominal thing for her. Mm-hmm. And so she just looked at me but there was more, and so but she said, well, she'll try it out. I said, okay, let's just try it out. Let's just look at it. And so we go to a mass right there on campus, you know, the Catholic campus mass.
Yeah.
And it's there in Duke Chapel. And so all the people are, I mean, and we were both struck by it. We were both struck by the beauty of the mass, but, kind of a silent beauty. It was in Duke Chapel, which is a huge place with just a few Catholics and so on. But so we were struck by it, but all the people started lining up to go do something. And we thought, well, so we lined up and then we march in there and they hand us something, the Eucharist, you know, so we just consumed the Eucharist and we just, you know, in other words, we didn't know anything.
Right. Right.
You know, we're just sort of showing up. And then, And then at one point, she liked it though. She liked it. And then I remember coming home to her and I remember saying, and I know we're about to run out of time, but I remember saying to her, you know, we're going to have to throw out our contraception. And so, and that was a serious thing. And she said, what, you know? And so, but she's, and so she, this was, that, this was a, that was probably the most difficult thing because for me, the faith was just totally sensible. You know, and I was reading Jumbo 2 and Veritas Splendor and everything, and so it all made complete sense, but so we had to, and I just realized we have to throw out the contraception because, and I saw how it was related to abortion and I saw how it was related to these things. I mean, so she was willing to do it, and we practiced natural family planning, and you know, but we were changed. Mm-hmm. It was amazing experience.
Yeah. Incredible odyssey, Matthew. Your story
really, really resonates with me in so many ways. And there's so many questions I want to ask. We are, you know, running out of time here, but with about 4 minutes left here, you know, just talk a little bit about what happened after. And then since then, I mean, there's so much has happened. I mean, you're now a prolific writer and you're a teacher. So just give us a sense of some of the things that have happened since then.
Well, we were blessed. I never thought about theology as a career. In fact, I still don't. I still feel like if theology ends as a, I don't think theology should be thought of as a career. I just don't think it should. So I've been blessed though. We went to Boston College. I decided I got to keep studying this. You know, I ended up getting a master's there at Duke while she was getting her master's. But then I thought I have to study at a Catholic place. I need to learn about the faith, about the sacraments, about God and Jesus. I need to really go deep into the Catholic tradition. I need to learn about Thomas Aquinas and Augustine and the great Greek fathers. So I got to go deep. I just told her I got to go deep. And so, there was this guy at Boston College named Father Matthew Lamb who became my mentor there. And I saw that he'd written an article in Communio. I was reading Communio at the time. But also, there are many other wonderful Providence things. And so I think the final thing I'd really like to mention is there at Duke, I had these two wonderful friends who, as I was becoming Catholic, I was at the Divinity School by that time. Yeah. You know, and so we were in our RCIA and... But I was hanging out there with Michael Dauphiné, who now is at Ave Maria, and doing wonderful things, and then with Tim Gray, who's the president now of the Augustine Institute. Mm. And so these two guys were also really helped enrich my faith. And so Tim kind of moved me away a bit from Balthazar and more toward Aquinas and to Scripture. And so Tim had a big impact on me. So just friendship then began. In other words, it wasn't all reading my way.
Sure.
And yeah, it was these friendships. Yeah. And then we began to have our children and so on.
Yeah. So I'm sure that there are people out there, you know, young people, older people, not religious people, some religious people, who wrestle again with that theme that really permeates the early part of your story of this. I don't even know what to call it, right? The darkness of faith, the hiddenness of God, right? Some of these, like, why is it so difficult, Lord? Why does it have to? And there's a mystery there. But to a person who's experiencing that, wrestling with that search, what is a word of encouragement you might leave them with?
Well, God exists. You know, so that's kind of the good news. And the good news is that God's revealed himself on the cross. And so to me, the cross is incredibly revelatory. Because the cross is mercy, the cross is love, you know, but it's also a profound solidarity with the person who is in darkness. There I see Job's cry fully answered. Yeah. So the cross, a Good Friday, has always just resonated with me, especially since I became Catholic. You know, the cross is such good news. It's incredible because the good news for me is that Jesus himself enters into that darkness. Yeah. You know, he enters right in there. And so if God is going to reveal himself, he's got to reveal himself like that. Mm-hmm. That's the only way that God could, because, you know, here we are struggling and striving and we're in a state of darkness through sin and you know, sort of the darkness that's come upon culture. Yeah. So we're here struggling. And so God reveals himself right at the heart of that.
Yeah.
He gets right into the depth, right into the darkness. He gets right there.
Yeah.
And so there is, you know, so I see that's God reveals himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right there in the darkness.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you so much.
No, thank
Matthew,
you
for coming to share your story and your insight, your wisdom. And again, a great word of encouragement there. Thank you for that. You know, if you're on a journey, right, if you're in the midst of that pursuit, keep going, right? Because God is seeking you much more passionately than you're seeking him, you know, keep searching, right?
Yeah, keep going with boldness, though. Yeah. And that's my grandpa. I got to give my grandpa that thanks, that he had this sense of countercultural boldness.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks so much. And thank you for being here for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Matthew's story is an inspiration to you. I remind you that if you're on a journey, if you're asking these questions, if you're wrestling, you're searching, number one, keep going. God loves you. He exists. He's searching for you. But we'd also like to pray for you and with you on your journey and to encourage you. So check out chnetwork.org and send us a note there. But in the meantime, we'll be back next week with another story. God bless.